I know, Adolin said.
It was wise then, Navani said. You mask your true skill. People can assume this was won by trickery, pit fighting instead of proper dueling. They might continue to underestimate you. I can work with this to get you more duels.
Adolin nodded, pretending that was why he'd done it.
15. A hand with the tower. Work form worn for strength and care. Whispering spren breathe at your ear. Seek first this form, its mysteries to bear. Found here is freedom from fear. From the Listener's Song of Listing, 19th stanza. Tradesman Tavlakov, Shallan said, I believe that you are wearing a different pair of shoes today than you were on the first day of our trip. Tavlakov stopped on his way to the evening fire, but adapted smoothly to her challenge. He turned toward her with a smile, shaking his head.
I fear you must be mistaken, Brightness. Just after leaving on this trip, I lost one of my clothing trunks to a storm. I have but this one pair of shoes to my name.
It was a flat-out lie. However, after 6 days of traveling together, she had discovered that Tavlakov didn't much mind being caught in a lie. Shallan perched on her wagon's front seat in the dim light, feet bandaged, staring Tavlakov down. She'd spent most of the day milking knobweed stems for their sap, then rubbing it on her feet to keep away the rot spren. She felt extremely satisfied to have noticed the plants. It showed that though she lacked much practical knowledge, some of her studies could be useful in the wild. Did she confront him about his lie? What would it accomplish? He didn't seem to get embarrassed by such things. He watched her in the darkness, eyes beady, shadowed. Well, Shallan said to him, that is unfortunate. Perhaps in our travels we will meet another merchant group with whom I can trade for proper footwear.
I will be certain to look for such an opportunity, Brightness.
Tavlakov gave her a bow and a fake smile, then continued toward the evening cook fire, which was burning fitfully. They were out of wood, and the parshman had gone out into the evening to search for more.
Lies,
Pattern said softly, his shape nearly invisible on the seat beside her. He knows if I can't walk, I'm more dependent upon him. Tavlakov settled down beside the struggling fire. Nearby, the chulls, unhooked from their wagons, lumbered around, crunching tiny rock buds beneath their gargantuan feet. They never strayed far. Tavlakov started whispering quietly with Tag, the mercenary. He kept a smile on his face, but she didn't trust those dark eyes of his, glittering in the firelight. Go see what he's saying, Shallan told Pattern.
See?
Listen to his words, then come back and repeat them to me. Don't get too close to the light. Pattern moved down the side of the wagon. Shallan leaned back against the hard seat, then took a small mirror she'd found in Yasna's trunk out of her safe pouch, along with a single sapphire sphere for light. Just a mark, nothing too bright, and it was failing at that. When is that next high storm due? Tomorrow? It was nearing the start of a new year, and that meant the weeping was coming, though not for a number of weeks. It was a light year, wasn't it? Well, she could endure high storms out here. She'd already been forced to suffer that indignity once, locked within her wagon. In the mirror, she could see that she looked awful. Red eyes with bags under them, her hair a frazzled mess, her dress frayed and soiled. She looked like a beggar who had found a once nice dress in a trash heap. It didn't bother her overly much. Was she worried about looking pretty for slavers? Hardly. However, Yasna hadn't cared what people thought of her, yet had always kept her appearance immaculate. Not that Yasna had acted alluringly, never for a moment. In fact, she disparaged such behavior in no uncertain terms. Using a fetching face to make a man buy you something is no different from a man using muscle to force someone to do the same, she'd said. Both methods are base, and both will fail a person as they age. No, Yasna had not approved of seduction as a tool. However, people responded differently to those who looked in control of themselves. But what can I do? Shallan thought. I have no makeup. I don't even have shoes to wear.
She could be someone important,
Tavlakov's voice said abruptly nearby. Shallan jumped, then looked to the side, where Pattern now rested on the seat beside her. The voice came from there.
She is trouble,
Tag's voice said. Pattern's vibrations produced a perfect imitation.
I still think we should just leave her and go. It is fortunate for us, Tavlakov's voice said, that the decision is not yours. You worry about making dinner. I shall worry about our little light-eyed companion. Someone is missing her, someone rich. If we can sell her back to them, Tag, it could be what finally digs us out.
Pattern imitated the sounds of a crackling fire for a short time, then fell silent. The precise reproduction of the conversation was marvelous. This, Shallan thought, could be very useful. Unfortunately, something needed to be done about Tavlakov. She couldn't have him regarding her as something to be sold back to those missing her. That was discomfortingly close to viewing her as a slave. If she let him continue in such a mindset, she'd spend the entire trip worrying about him and his thugs. So what would Yasna do in this situation? Gritting her teeth, Shallan slipped down off the wagon, stepping gingerly on her wounded feet. She could walk, barely. She waited for the pain spren to retreat. Then, covering up her agony, she approached the meager fire and sat down. Tag, you are excused. He looked to Tavlakov, who nodded. Tag retreated to check on the parshman. Bluth had gone to scout the area, as he often did at night, checking for signs of others passing this way. It is time to discuss your payment, Shallan said.
Service to one so illustrious is payment in itself, of course.
Of course, she said, meeting his eyes. Don't back down. You can do this. But a merchant must make a living. I am not blind, Tavlakov. Your men do not agree with your decision to help me. They think it is a waste. Tavlakov glanced at Tag, looking unsettled. Hopefully he wondered what else she had guessed. Upon arriving at the Shattered Plains, Shallan said, I will acquire a grand fortune. I do not have it yet.
That is unfortunate.
Not in the slightest, Shallan said. It is an opportunity, tradesman Tavlakov. The fortune I will acquire is the result of a betrothal. If I arrive safely, those who rescued me, saved me from pirates, sacrificed greatly to see me brought to my new family, will undoubtedly be well rewarded.
I am but a humble servant, Tavlakov said with a broad false smile. Rewards are the farthest thing from my mind.
He thinks I'm lying about the fortune. Shallan ground her teeth in frustration, anger beginning to burn inside of her. This was just what Capsule had done, treating her like a plaything, a means to an end, not a real person. She leaned closer to Tavlakov into the firelight. Do not toy with me, slaver.
I wouldn't dare. You have no idea the storm you have wandered into,
Shallan hissed, holding his eyes.
You have no idea what stakes have been wagered upon my arrival. Take your petty schemes and stuff them in a crevice. Do as I say and I will see your debts canceled. You will be a free man again. What? How did you...
Shallan stood up, cutting him off. She felt somehow stronger than she had before, more determined. Her insecurities fluttered in the pit of her stomach, but she paid them no heed. Tavlakov didn't know she was timid. He didn't know she had been raised in rural isolation. To him, she was a woman of the court, accomplished at argument and accustomed to being obeyed. Standing before him, feeling radiant in the glow of the flames, towering above him and his grubby machinations, she saw. Expectation wasn't just about what people expected of you. It was about what you expected of yourself. Tavlakov leaned away from her like a man before a raging bonfire. He shrank back, eyes wide, raising an arm. Shallan realized that she was glowing faintly with the light of spheres. Her dress no longer bore the tears and smudges it had before. It was majestic. Instinctively, she let the glow from her skin fade, hoping Tavlakov would think it a trick of the firelight. She spun and left him shaking beside the fire as she walked back to the wagon. Darkness was fully upon them, the first moon having yet to rise. As she walked, her feet didn't hurt nearly as much as they had. Was the knobweed sap doing that much good? She reached the wagon and began climbing back into the seat, but Bluth chose that moment to crash into camp.
"Put out the fire!" he cried.
Tavlakov looked at him, dumbfounded. Bluth dashed ahead, passing Shallan and reaching the fire where he grabbed the pot of steaming broth. He turned it over onto the flames, splashing out ashes and steam with a hiss, scattering flame spren which faded away. Tavlakov jumped up, looking down as filthy broth, faintly lit by the dying embers, ran past his feet. Shallan, gritting her teeth against the pain, got off the wagon and approached. Tag ran up from the other direction.
"Seem to be several dozen of them," Bluth was saying in a low voice. "They are well armed, but have no horses or chulls, so they are not rich."
"What is this?" Shallan demanded.
"Bandits," Bluth said. "Or mercenaries, or whatever you want to call them."
"Nobody polices this area, Brightness,"
Tavlakov said. He glanced at her, then looked away quickly, obviously still shaken.
"It is truly a wilderness, you see. The presence of the Alethi on the Shattered Plains means many like to come and go. Trading caravans like ours, craftsmen seeking work. Lowborn light-eyed sellswords with an eye toward enlisting. Those two conditions, no laws, but plenty of travellers, attract a certain kind of ruffian."
"Dangerous,"
Tag agreed.
"These types take what they want, leaving only corpses."
"Did they see our fire?"
Tavlakov asked, wringing his cap in his hands.
"Don't know,"
Bluth said, glancing over his shoulder. Shallan could barely make out his expression in the darkness.
"Didn't want to get too close. I snuck up to get a count, then ran back here fast."
"How can you be sure they're bandits?" Shallan asked. "They might just be soldiers on their way to the Shattered Plains, as Tavlakov said."
"They fly no banners. Display no sigils," Bluth said. "But they have good equipment and keep a tight guard. They're deserters. I'd bet the chulls on it."
"Bah," Tavlakov said. "You'd bet my chulls on a hand with the tower, Bluth. But Brightness, for all his terrible gambling sands, I believe the fool is right. We must harness the chulls and depart immediately. The Night's Darkness is our ally, and we must make the most of it."
She nodded. The men moved quickly, even the portly Tavlakov, breaking down camp and hooking up the chulls. The slaves grumbled at not getting their food for the night. Shallan stopped beside their cage, feeling ashamed. Her family had owned slaves, and not just Parshmen and Ardents, ordinary slaves. In most cases, they were nothing worse than dark eyes without the right of travel. These poor souls, however, were sickly and half-starved. "You're only one step from being in one of those pens yourself, Shallan," she thought with a shiver, as Tevlakov passed, hissing curses at the captives. No, he wouldn't dare put you in there. He'd just kill you. Bluth had to be reminded again to give her a hand up into the wagon. Tag ushered the Parshmen into their wagon, cursing at them for moving so slowly, then climbed into his seat and took up the tail position. The first moon began to rise, making it lighter than Shallan would have liked. It seemed to her that each crunching footstep of the Chulls was as loud as a high storm's thunder. They brushed the plants she'd named crust spines, with their branches like tubes of sandstone. Those cracked and shook. Progress was not quick. Chulls never were. As they moved, she picked out lights on a hillside, frighteningly close. Campfires not a 10-minute walk away. A shifting of winds brought the sound of distant voices, of metal on metal, perhaps men sparring. Tevlakov turned the wagons eastward. Shallan frowned in the night. "Why this way?" she whispered.
"Remember that gully we saw?" Bluth whispered, "putting it between us and them, in case they hear and come looking."
Shallan nodded. "What can we do if they catch us?"
"It won't be good."
"Couldn't we bribe our way past them?"
"Deserters ain't like common bandits," Bluth said. "These men, they've given up everything. Oaths, families. When you desert, it breaks you. It leaves you willing to do anything because you've already given away everything you could have cared about losing."
"Wow," Shallan said, looking over her shoulder.
You spend your whole life with a decision like that, you do. You wish any honor were left for you, but you know you've already given it away."
He fell silent, and Shallan was too nervous to prod him further. She continued watching those lights on the hillside as the wagons, blessedly, rolled farther and farther into the night, eventually escaping into the darkness.
16. Swordmaster. Nimble form has a delicate touch, gave the gods this form to many. Though once defied by the gods, they were crushed. This form craves precision and plenty. From the Listener Song of Listing, 27th stanza. "You know," Moash said from Kaladin's side, "I always thought this place would be..."
"Bigger?"
Drahi offered in his lightly accented voice. "Better," Moash said, looking around the practice grounds. "It looks just like where dark-eyed soldiers practice." These sparring grounds were reserved for Dalinar's light eyes. In the center, the large open courtyard was filled with a thick layer of sand. A raised wooden walkway ran around the perimeter, stretching between the sand and the narrow surrounding building, which was just one room deep. That narrow building wrapped around the courtyard except at the front, which had a wall with an archway for the entrance, and had a wide roof that extended, giving shade to the wooden walkway. Light-eyed officers stood chatting in the shade or watching men sparring in the sunlight of the yard, and Ardents moved this way and that, delivering weapons or drinks. It was a common layout for training grounds. Kaladin had been in several buildings like this, mostly back when he'd first been training in Amaram's army. Kaladin set his jaw, resting his fingers on the archway leading into the training grounds. It had been 7 days since Amaram's arrival in the war camps, 7 days of dealing with the fact that Amaram and Dalinar were friends. He'd decided to be storming happy about Amaram's arrival. After all, it meant that Kaladin would be able to find a chance to finally stick a spear in that man. "No," he thought, entering the training grounds, "not a spear, a knife. I want to be up close to him, face to face, so I can watch him panic as he dies. I want to feel that knife going in." Kaladin waved to his men and entered through the archway, forcing himself to focus on his surroundings instead of Amaram. That archway was good stone, quarried nearby, built into a structure with the traditional eastward reinforcement. Judging by the modest creme deposits, these walls hadn't been here long. It was another sign that Dalinar was starting to think of the war camps as permanent. He was taking down simple temporary buildings and replacing them with sturdy structures. "I don't know what you expected," Dre said to Moash as he inspected the grounds. "How would you make sparring grounds different for the Light Eyes? Use diamond dust instead of sand?" "Ouch," Kaladin said. "I don't know how," Moash said. "It's just that they make such a big deal of it. No Dark Eyes on the special sparring grounds. I don't see what makes them special."
"That's because you don't think like Light Eyes," Kaladin said. "This place is special for one simple reason."
"Why is that?" Moash asked.
"Because we're not here," Kaladin said, leading the way in. "Not normally, at least."
He had with him Dre and Moash, along with five other men, a mix of Bridge Four members and a few survivors of the old Cobalt Guard. Dalinar had assigned those to Kaladin, and to Kaladin's surprise and pleasure, they had accepted him as their leader without a word of complaint. To a man, he'd been impressed with them. The old guard had deserved its reputation. A few, all dark-eyed, had started eating with Bridge Four. They'd asked for Bridge Four patches, and Kaladin had gotten them some, but ordered them to put their Cobalt Guard patches on the other shoulder and continue to wear them as a mark of pride. Spear in hand, Kaladin led his team toward a group of Ardents who bustled in their direction. The Ardents wore Borin religious garb, loose trousers and tunics tied at the waist with simple robes, pauper's clothing. They were slaves, and then they also weren't. Kaladin had never given much thought to them. His mother would probably lament how little Kaladin cared for religious observance. The way Kaladin figured it, the Almighty didn't show much concern for him, so why care back?
"This is the Light Eyes training ground," said the lead Ardent sternly.
She was a willowy woman, though you weren't supposed to think of Ardents as male or female. She had her head shaven, like all Ardents. Her male companions wore square beards with clean upper lips. "Captain Kaladin, Bridge Four," Kaladin said, scanning the practice grounds and shouldering his spear. It would be very easy for an accident to happen here during sparring. He'd have to watch for that. "Here to guard the Kolin boys while they practice today."
"Captain,"
one of the Ardents scoffed, "you—" Another Ardent silenced him by whispering something. News about Kaladin had traveled quickly through camp, but Ardents could be an isolated lot sometimes. "Dre," Kaladin said, pointing. "See those rock buds growing up on the top of the wall there?"
"Yep."
"They're cultivated. That means there's a way up."
"Of course there is," the lead Ardent said. "The stairwell is at the northwestern corner. I have the key."
"Good. You can let him in," Kaladin said. "Dre, keep an eye on things from up there."
"On it,"
Dre said, trotting in the direction of the stairwell.
"And what kinds of danger do you expect them to be in here?" the Ardent said, folding her arms.
"I see lots of weapons," Kaladin said. "Lots of people moving in and out, and... are those shard blades I see? I wonder what could possibly go wrong." He gave her a pointed look. The woman sighed, then handed her key to an assistant who jogged off after Dre. Kaladin pointed to positions for his other men to watch from. They moved off, leaving only him and Moash. The lean man had turned immediately at the mention of shard blades and now watched them hungrily. A pair of light-eyed men bearing them had moved out into the center of the sands. One blade was long and thin, with a large crossguard, while the other was wide and enormous, with wicked spikes, slightly flame-like, jutting out of both sides along the lower third. Both weapons had a protective strip on the edges, like a partial sheath.
"Huh,"
Moash said.
"I don't recognize either of those men. I thought I knew all the shard-bearers in camp."
"Those aren't shard-bearers," the Ardent said. "They're using the king's blades."
"Elokar lets people use his shard blade?" Kaladin asked.
"It is a grand tradition,"
the Ardent said, seeming annoyed that she had to explain.
The High Princes used to do it in their own princedoms before the reunification, and now it is the king's obligation and honor. Men may use the king's blade and plate to practice. The light eyes of our armies must be trained with shards for the good of all. Blade and plate are difficult to master, and if a shard-bearer falls in battle, it is important that others be capable of their immediate use.
That made sense, Kaladin supposed, though he found it hard to imagine any light eyes letting someone else touch his blade.
The king has two shard blades? One is that of his father, kept for the tradition of training shard-bearers.
The Ardent glanced at the sparring men.
Alethkar has always had the finest shard-bearers in the world. This tradition is part of it. The king has hinted that someday he might bestow his father's blade upon a worthy warrior.
Kaladin nodded in appreciation.
Not bad, he said. I'll bet that a lot of men come to practice with them, each hoping to prove he's the most skilled and most deserving. A good way for Alethkar to trick a bunch of men into training.
The Ardent huffed and walked away. Kaladin watched the shard blades flash in the air. The men using them barely knew what they were doing. The real shard bearers he'd seen, the real shard bearers he'd fought, hadn't lurched about swinging the oversized swords like pole arms. Even Adolin's duel the other day had...
"Storms, Kaladin," Moash said, watching the Ardent stalk away. "And you were telling me to be respectful?"
"Hmm?"
"You didn't use an honorific for the king," Moash said. "Then you implied that the Light Eyes coming to practice were lazy and needed to be tricked into it. I thought we were supposed to avoid antagonizing the Light Eyes."
Kaladin looked away from the shard bearers. Distracted, he'd spoken thoughtlessly.
"You're right," he said. "Thanks for the reminder."
Moash nodded.
"I want you by the gate," Kaladin said, pointing.
A group of parshmen came in, bearing boxes, probably foodstuffs.
Those wouldn't be dangerous, would they?
Pay particularly close attention to servants, sword runners, or anyone else seemingly innocuous who approaches High Prince Dalinar's sons. A knife to the side from someone like that would be one of the best ways to pull off an assassination.
Fine. But tell me something, Cal. Who is this Amaram fellow?
Kaladin turned sharply toward Moash.
"I see how you look at him," Moash said. "I see how your face gets when the other bridgemen mention him. What did he do to you?"
"I was in his army," Kaladin said. "The last place I fought before."
Moash gestured to Kaladin's forehead.
"That's his work, then?"
"Yeah."
"So he's not the hero people say he is," Moash said.
He seemed pleased by that fact.
"His soul is as dark as any I've ever known."
Moash took Kaladin by the arm.
"We are going to get back at them somehow. Sadius, Amaram, the ones who have done these things to us."
Angerspren boiled up around him like pools of blood in the sand. Kaladin met Moash's eyes, then nodded.
"Good enough for me," Moash said,
shouldering his spear and jogging off toward the position Kaladin had indicated, the Spren vanishing.
"He's another who needs to learn to smile more,"
Syl whispered. Kaladin hadn't noticed her flitting nearby, and now she settled down on his shoulder. Kaladin turned to walk around the perimeter of the practice grounds, noting each entrance. Perhaps he was being overly cautious. He just liked doing jobs well, and it had been a lifetime since he'd had a job other than saving Bridge 4. Sometimes, though, it seemed like his job was impossible to do well. During the high storm last week, someone had again sneaked into Dalinar's rooms, scrolling a second number on the wall. Counting it down, it pointed at the same date a little over a month away. The High Prince didn't seem worried and wanted the event kept quiet. Storms. Was he writing the glyphs himself while he had fits? Or was it some kind of spren? Kaladin was sure nobody could have gotten past him this time to get in.
"Do you want to talk about the thing that is bothering you?"
Syl asked from her perch.
"I'm worried about what's happening during the high storms with Dalinar," Kaladin said. "Those numbers. Something is wrong. You still seeing those spren about?"
"Red lightning?"
she asked.
I think so. They're hard to spot. You haven't seen them?
Kaladin shook his head, hefting his spear and walking over onto the walkway around the sands. Here, he peeked into a storage room. Wooden practice swords, some the size of shard blades, and sparring leathers lined the wall.
Is that all that's bothering you?
Syl asked. What else would be?
Amaram and Dalinar.
It's not a big deal. Dalinar Kolin is friends with one of the worst murderers I've ever met. So? Dalinar is light-eyed. He's probably friends with a lot of murderers.
Kaladin, Syl said.
Amaram's worse than Satius, you know, Kaladin said, walking around the storage room, checking for doorways. Everyone knows that Satius is a rat. He's straight with you. You're a bridgeman, he told me, and I'm going to use you up until you die. Amaram, though? He promised to be more. A bright lord like those in the stories. He told me he'd protect Tien. He feigned honor. That's worse than any depth Satius could ever reach.
Dalinar's not like Amaram, Syl said. You know he's not.
People say the same things about him that they did of Amaram. That they still do of Amaram. Kaladin stepped back out into the sunlight and continued his circuit of the grounds, passing dueling light eyes who kicked up sand as they grunted, sweated, and clacked wooden swords against one another. Each pair was attended by a half-dozen dark-eyed servants carrying towels and canteens, and many had a parchment or two bring them chairs to sit on when they rested. Stormfather! Even in something routine like this, the light eyes had to be pampered. Syl zipped out into the air in front of Kaladin, coming down like a storm. Literally like a storm. She stopped in the air right in front of him, a cloud boiling from beneath her feet, flashing with lightning.
You can honestly say, she demanded, that you think Dalinar Kolin is only pretending to be honorable?
Don't you lie to me, Kaladin, she said, stepping forward, pointing. Diminutive though she was, in that moment she seemed as vast as a high storm.
No lies. Ever.
He took a deep breath. No, he finally said. No. Dalinar gave up his blade for us. He's a good man. I accept that. Amaram has him fooled. He had me fooled too, so I suppose I can't blame Kolin too much. Syl nodded curtly, the cloud dissipating.
You should talk to him about Amaram,
she said, walking in the air beside Kaladin's head as he continued scouting the structure. Her steps were small, and she should have fallen behind, but she didn't. And what would I say? Kaladin asked. Should I go to him and accuse a Light Eyes of the Third Dawn of murdering his own troops? Of stealing my shard blade? I'll sound like either a fool or a madman.
But...
He won't listen, Syl, Kaladin said. Dalinar Kolin might be a good man, but he won't let me speak ill of a powerful Light Eyes. It's the way of the world, and that is truth. He continued his inspection, wanting to know what was in the rooms where people could watch people spar. Some were for storage, others for bathing and resting. Several of those were locked, with Light Eyes inside recovering from their daily sparring. Light Eyes liked baths. The backside of the structure, opposite the entrance gate, held the living quarters for the Ardens. Kaladin had never seen so many shaved heads and robed bodies scurrying about. Back in Hearthstone, the city lord had kept only a few wizened old Ardens for tutoring his son. Those had also come down to the town periodically to burn prayers and elevate Dark Eyes' callings. These Ardens didn't seem to be the same type. They had the physiques of warriors and would often step in to practice with Light Eyes who needed a sparring partner. Some of the Ardens had dark eyes, but still used the sword. They weren't considered light-eyed or dark-eyed. They were just Ardens.
And what do I do if one of them decides to try killing the princelings?
Storms, but he hated some aspects of bodyguard duty. If nothing happened, then you were never sure if it was because nothing was wrong, or because you had deterred potential assassins. Adolin and his brother finally arrived, both fully armored in their shard plate, helms under their arms.
They were accompanied by Scar and a handful of former members of the Cobalt Guard. Those saluted Kaladin as he walked up and gestured that they were dismissed. The shift officially changed. Scar would be off to join Teft and the group protecting Delinar and Navani.
"The area is as secure as I can make it without disrupting training, Bright Lord," Kaladin said, walking up to Adolin. "My men and I will keep an eye out while you spar, but don't hesitate to give a holler if something seems amiss."
Adolin grunted, surveying the place, barely paying Kaladin any heed. He was a tall man, his black alethi hairs overwhelmed by quite a bit of golden blonde. His father didn't have that. Adolin's mother had been from Rira, perhaps? Kaladin turned to walk toward the northern side of the courtyard, where he'd have a different view from Moash.
"Bridgman," Adolin called. "You've decided to start using proper titles for people? Didn't you call my father Sir?"
"He's in my chain of command," Kaladin said, turning back. The simple answer seemed the best.
"And I'm not?" Adolin asked, frowning.
"No."
"And if I give you an order?"
"I'll comply with any reasonable requests, Bright Lord. But if you wish for someone to fetch you tea between bouts, you'll have to send someone else. There should be plenty here willing to lick your heels."
Adolin stepped up to him. Though the deep blue shard plate added only a few inches to his height, he seemed to tower because of it. Perhaps that line about licking heels had been brash. Adolin represented something, though. The privilege of the light eyes. He wasn't like Amaram or Sadius, who brought out Kaladin's hatred. Men like Adolin just annoyed him, reminding him that in this world some sipped wine and wore fancy clothing, while others were made slaves almost on a whim.
"I owe you my life," Adolin growled, as if it hurt to say the words. "That's the only reason I haven't yet thrown you through a window."
He reached up with a gauntleted finger and tapped at Kaladin's chest. "But my patience with you won't extend as far as my father's, little bridge man. There's something off about you, something I can't put my finger on. I'm watching you. Remember your place."
"Great." "I'll keep you alive, Bright Lord," Kaladin said, pushing aside the finger. "That's my place."
"I can keep myself alive," Adolin said, turning away and tromping across the sand with a clink of plate. "Your job is to watch over my brother."
Kaladin was more than happy to let him leave.
"Spoiled child," he muttered.
Kaladin supposed that Adolin was a few years older than him. Just recently, Kaladin had realized that he'd passed his 20th birthday while a bridge man and never known it. Adolin was in his early 20s, but being a child had little to do with age. Renarin still stood awkwardly near the front gate, wearing Dalinar's former shard plate, carrying his newly won shard blade. Adolin's quick duel from yesterday was the talk of the war camps, and it would take Renarin 5 days to fully bond his blade before he could dismiss it. The young man's shard plate was the color of dark steel, unpainted. That was how Dalinar had preferred it. By giving his plate away, Dalinar suggested that he felt he needed to win his next victories as a politician. It was a laudable move. You couldn't always have men following you because they feared you could beat them up, or even because you were the best soldier among them. You needed more, far more, to be a true leader. Yet Kaladin did wish Dalinar had kept the plate. Anything that helped the man stay alive would have been a boon for Bridge Four. Kaladin leaned back against a column, folding his arms, spear in the crook of his arm, watching the area for trouble and inspecting everyone that got too close to the princelings. Adolin walked over and grabbed his brother by the shoulder, towing him across the courtyard. Various people sparring in the square stopped and bowed, if not in uniform, or saluted the princelings as they passed. A group of gray-clothed Ardents had gathered at the back of the courtyard, and the woman from earlier stepped forward to chat with the brothers. Adolin and Renarin both bowed formally to her. It had been 3 weeks now since Renarin had been given his plate. Why had Adolin waited so long to bring him here for training? Had he been waiting until the duel, so he could win the lad a blade, too? Syl landed on Kaladin's shoulder.
Adolin and Renarin are both bowing to her.
Yeah, Kaladin said.
But isn't the Ardent a slave?
One their father owns? Kaladin nodded.
Humans don't make sense.
If you're only now learning that, Kaladin said, then you haven't been paying attention. Syl tossed her hair, which moved realistically. The gesture itself was very human. Perhaps she'd been paying attention after all.
I don't like them, she said airily. Either one, Adolin or Renarin.
You don't like anyone who carries shards.
Exactly.
You called the blades abominations before, Kaladin said. But the Radiants carried them. So were the Radiants wrong to do so?
Of course not, she said,
sounding like he was saying something completely stupid.
The shards weren't abominations back then.
What changed?
The knights, Syl said, growing quiet. The knights changed.
So it's not that the weapons are abominations specifically, Kaladin said. It's that the wrong people are carrying them.
There are no right people anymore, Syl whispered. Maybe there never were.
And where did they come from in the first place? Kaladin asked. Shard blades, shard plate. Even modern fabrials are nowhere near as good. So where did the ancients get weapons so amazing? Syl fell silent. She had a frustrating habit of doing that when his questions got too specific. Well, he prompted.
I wish I could tell you.
Then do.
I wish it worked that way. It doesn't.
Kaladin sighed, turning his attention back to Adolin and Renarin, where it was supposed to be. The Senior Ardent had led them to the very back of the courtyard, where another group of people sat on the ground. They were Ardents too, but something was different about them. Teachers of some sort? As Adolin spoke to them, Kaladin did another quick scan around the courtyard, then frowned.
Kaladin?
Syl asked. Man in the shadows over there, Kaladin said, gesturing with his spear toward a place under the eaves. A man stood there, leaning cross-armed against a waist-high wooden railing. He's watching the princelings.
So is everyone else.
He's different, Kaladin said. Come on. Kaladin wandered over casually, unthreatening. The man was probably just a servant. Long-haired, with a short but scruffy black beard, he wore loose tan clothing tied with ropes. He looked out of place in the sparring yard, and that itself was probably enough to indicate he wasn't an assassin. The best assassins never stood out. Still, the man had a robust build and a scar on his cheek, so he'd seen fighting. Best to check on him. The man watched Renarin and Adolin intently, and from this angle, Kaladin couldn't see if his eyes were light or dark. As Kaladin got close, his foot audibly scraped the sand. The man spun immediately, and Kaladin leveled his spear by instinct. He could see the man's eyes now. They were brown. But Kaladin had trouble placing his age. Those eyes seemed old somehow, but the man's skin didn't seem wrinkled enough to match them. He could have been 35, or he could have been 70.
Too young, Kaladin thought, though he couldn't say why.
Kaladin lowered his spear. Sorry, I'm a little jumpy. First few weeks on the job. He tried to say it disarmingly. It didn't work. The man looked him up and down, still showing the chained menace of a warrior deciding whether or not to strike. Finally, he turned away from Kaladin and relaxed, watching Adolin and Renarin. "Who are you?" Kaladin asked, stepping up beside the man. "I'm new, as I said. I'm trying to learn everyone's names."
"You're the bridge man, the one who saved the High Prince."
"I am," Kaladin said.
"You don't need to keep prying," the man said. "I'm not gonna hurt your damnation, Prince."
He had a low, grinding voice. Scratchy. Strange accent, too. "He's not my prince," Kaladin said. "Just my responsibility." He looked the man over again, noticing something. The light clothing, tied with ropes, was very similar to what some of the Ardents were wearing. The full head of hair had thrown Kaladin off.
"You're a soldier," Kaladin guessed. "Ex-soldier, I mean."
"Yeah," the man said. "They call me Zyle."
Kaladin nodded, the irregularities clicking into place. Occasionally a soldier retired to the Ardentia, if he had no other life to return to. Kaladin would have expected them to require the man to at least shave his head.
"I wonder if Hav is in one of these monasteries somewhere," Kaladin thought idly. "What would he think of me now?"
He'd probably be proud. He always had seen guard duty as the most respectable of a soldier's assignments.
"What are they doing?"
Kaladin asked Zyle, nodding toward Renarin and Adolin, who, despite the encumbrance of their shard plate, had seated themselves on the ground before the elder Ardents. Zyle grunted.
"A younger Colin has to be chosen by a master for training."
"Can't they just pick whichever one they want?"
"Doesn't work that way. It's kind of an awkward situation, though. Prince Renarin, he's never practiced much with a sword."
Zyle paused.
"Being chosen by a master is a step that most light-eyed boys of suitable rank take by the time they're 10.
Kaladin frowned.
"Why didn't he ever train?"
"Health problems of some sort."
"And they'd really turn him down?" Kaladin asked. "The High Prince's own son?"
"They could, but they probably won't. Not brave enough."
The man narrowed his eyes as Adolin stood up and gestured.
"Damnation. I knew it was suspicious that he waited for this until I got back."
"Swordmaster Zyle," Adolin called. "You aren't sitting with the others."
Zyle sighed, then gave Kaladin a resigned glance.
"I'm probably not brave enough either. I'll try not to hurt him too much."
He walked around the railing and jogged over. Adolin clasped Zyle's hand eagerly, then pointed to Renarin. Zyle looked distinctly out of place among the other Ardents with their bald heads, neatly trimmed beards, and cleaner clothing.
"Huh,"
Kaladin said.
"Did he seem odd to you?"
"You all seem odd to me," Syl said lightly. "Everyone but Rock, who is a complete gentleman."
"He thinks you're a god. You shouldn't encourage him."
"Why not? I am a god."
He turned his head, looking at her flatly as she sat on his shoulder. "Syl."
"What? I am."
She grinned and held up her fingers as if pinching something very small.
"A little piece of one? Very, very little. You have permission to bow to me now?"
"Kind of hard to do that when you're sitting on my shoulder," he mumbled.
He noticed Lopun and Shen arriving at the gate, likely bearing the daily reports from Teft.
"Come on, let's see if Teft has anything he needs from me. Then we'll do a circuit and check Andre and Moash."
17. A Pattern. Dull form dread, with the mind most lost, the lowest, and one not bright. To find this form one need banish the cost. It finds you and brings you to blight. From the Listener's Song of Listing, final stanza. Riding on her wagon, Shallan covered her anxiety with scholarship. There was no way to tell if the deserters had spotted the trails of crushed rock buds made by the caravan. They might be following. They might not be. No use dwelling on it, she told herself, and so she found a distraction. The leaves can start their own shoots, she said, holding up one of the small round leaves on the tip of her finger. She turned it toward the sunlight. Bluth sat beside her, hulking like a boulder. Today he wore a hat that was entirely too stylish for him, dusty white, with a brim that folded upward at the sides. He would occasionally flick his guiding reed. It was at least as long as Shallan was tall, on the shell of the chull ahead. Shallan had made a small list of the beats he used in the back of her book. Bluth hit twice, paused, and hit again. That made the animal slow as the wagon in front of them, driven by Tavlakov, began moving up a hillside covered in tiny rock buds. "You see?" Shallan said, showing him the leaf. "That's why the plant's limbs are so fragile. When the storm comes, it will shatter these branches and break off the leaves. They will blow away and start new shoots, building their own shell. They grow so quickly. Faster than I'd have expected out here in these infertile lands." Bluth grunted. Shallan sighed, lowering her finger and putting the tiny plant back in the cup she'd been using to nurture it. She glanced over her shoulder. No sign of pursuit. She really should just stop worrying. She turned back to her new sketchbook, one of Yasna's notebooks that didn't have many pages filled, then began a quick sketch of the small leaf. She didn't have very good materials, only a single charcoal pencil, some pens, and a little ink. But pattern had been right. She could not stop. She had begun with a replacement sketch of the Xanthid as she remembered it from her dip in the sea. The picture wasn't equal to the one she'd crafted right after the event, but having it again, in any form, had started healing the wounds inside. She finished the leaf, then turned the page and began a sketch of Bluth. She didn't particularly want to restart her collection of people with him, but her options were limited. Unfortunately, that hat really did look silly. It was far too small for his head. The image of him huddled forward like a crab, back to the sky and hat on his head. Well, at least it would be an interesting composition. "Where did you get the hat?" she asked as she sketched.
"Traded for it," Bluth mumbled, not looking at her.
"Did it cost much?" He shrugged. Shallan had lost her own hats in the sinking, but had persuaded Tavlakov to give her one of the ones woven by the parchman. It wasn't particularly attractive, but it kept the sun off her face. Despite the bumping wagon, Shallan eventually managed to finish her sketch of Bluth. She inspected it, dissatisfied. It was a poor way to start her collection, particularly as she felt she'd caricatured him somewhat. She pursed her lips. What would Bluth look like if he weren't always scowling at her, if his clothing were neater, if he carried a proper weapon instead of that old cudgel? She flipped the page and started again. A different composition, idealized perhaps, but somehow also right. He could actually look dashing once you dressed him up properly. A uniform, a spear planted to his side, eyes toward the horizon. By the time she'd finished, she was feeling much better about the day. She smiled at the product, then held it up to Bluth as Tavlakov called the midday halt. Bluth glanced at the picture but said nothing. He gave the chull a few whacks to stop it alongside the one pulling Tavlakov's wagon. Tag rolled up his wagon. He carried the slaves this time. "Knobweed," Shallan said, lowering her sketch and pointing at a patch of thin reeds growing behind a nearby rock. Bluth groaned.
"More of that plant?"
"Yes, would you kindly fetch them for me?"
"Can't the parchman do it? I'm supposed to feed the chulls."
"Which would you rather make wait, Guardsman Bluth? The chulls? Or the light-eyed woman?" Bluth scratched his head underneath the hat, then sullenly climbed down from the wagon and walked toward the reeds. Nearby, Tavlakov stood on his wagon watching the horizon to the south. A thin trail of smoke rose in that direction. Shallan felt an immediate chill. She scrambled from the wagon and hurried to Tavlakov. "Storms," Shallan said. "Is it the deserters? They are following us?"
"Yes. They have stopped to cook for midday, it seems," Tavlakov said from his perch atop his wagon. "They do not care about us seeing their fire." He forced out a laugh. "That is a good sign. They probably know we are only three wagons and are barely worth chasing. So long as we keep moving and don't stop often, they will give up the chase. Yes, I'm Zatan. He hopped down from his wagon, then hurriedly began to water the slaves. He didn't bother to make the parshman do it. He did the work himself. That, more than anything, testified to his nervousness. He wanted to be moving again quickly. That left the parshman to continue weaving in their cage behind Tavlakov's wagon. Anxious, Shallan stood there watching. The deserters had spotted the wagon's trail of broken rock buds. She found herself sweating, but what could she do? She couldn't hurry the caravan. She had to simply hope, as Tavlakov said, that they could stay ahead of pursuit. That didn't seem likely. The Chul wagons couldn't be faster than marching men. Distract yourself, Shallan thought as she started to panic. Find something to take your mind off the pursuit. What about Tavlakov's parshmen? Shallan eyed them. Perhaps a drawing of the two of them in their cage? No. She was too nervous for drawing, but perhaps she could find something out. She walked to the parshmen. Her feet complained, but the pain was manageable. In fact, in contrast to how she'd covered it up on previous days, now she exaggerated her winces. Better to make Tavlakov think she was less well than she was. She stopped at the cage's bars. The back was unlocked. Parshman never ran. Buying these two must have been quite an investment for Tavlakov. Parshmen weren't cheap, and many monarchs and powerful light eyes hoarded them. One of the two glanced at Shallan, then returned back to his work. Her work? It was difficult to tell the males from the females without undressing them. Both of these two had red-on-white marbled skin. They had squat bodies, perhaps 5 feet tall, and were bald. It was difficult to see these two humble workers as a threat. What are your names? Shallan asked. One looked up. The other kept working. Your name? Shallan prodded. One, the parshman said. He pointed at his companion. Two. He put his head down and kept working. Are you happy with your life? Shallan asked. Would you rather be free, given the chance? The parshman looked up at her and frowned. He scrunched up his brow, mouthing a few of the words, then shook his head. He didn't understand. Freedom? Shallan prodded. He hunched down to work. He actually looks uncomfortable, Shallan thought, embarrassed for not understanding. His posture seemed to say, please stop asking me questions. Shallan tucked her sketchbook under her arm and took a memory of the two of them working there. These are evil monsters, she told herself forcefully. Creatures of legend who will soon be bent on destroying everyone and everything around them. Standing here, looking in at them, she found it difficult to believe, even though she had accepted the evidence. Storms. Yasna was right. Persuading the Light Eyes to rid themselves of their parshmen was going to be nearly impossible. She would need very, very solid proof. Troubled, she walked back to her seat and climbed up, making sure to wince. Bluth had left her a bundle of knobweed and was now caring for the Chulls. Tavlakov was digging out some food for a quick lunch, which they'd probably eat while moving. She quieted her nerves and forced herself to do some sketches of nearby plants. She soon moved on to a sketch of the horizon and the rock formations nearby. The air didn't feel as cold as it had during her first days with the slavers, though her breath still steamed before her in the mornings. As Tavlakov passed by, he gave her an uncomfortable glance. He had treated her differently since their confrontation at the fire last night. Shallan continued sketching. It was certainly a lot flatter out here than back home, and there were far fewer plants, though they were more robust. And was that another column of smoke up ahead? She stood up and raised a hand to shade her eyes. Yes, more smoke. She looked southward,
toward the pursuing mercenaries. Nearby, Tag stopped, noticing what she had. He hustled over to Tavlakov, and the two started arguing softly. "Tradesman Tavlakov?" Shallan refused to call him Trade Master, as would be his proper title as a full merchant. "I would hear your discussion."
"Of course, Brightness, of course."
He waddled over, wringing his hands.
"You have seen the smoke ahead. We have entered a corridor running between the Shattered Plains and the Shallow Crypts and its sister villages. There is more traffic here than in other parts of the Frostlands, you see. So it is not unexpected that we should encounter others."
"Those ahead?"
"Another caravan, if we are lucky."
"And if we're unlucky?" She didn't need to ask. "It would mean more deserters, or bandits."
"We can avoid them," Tavlakov said. "Only a large group would dare make smoke for midday meals, as it is an invitation, or a warning. The small caravans like ourselves do not risk it." "If it's a large caravan," Tag said, rubbing his brow with a thick finger. "They'll have guards. Good protection."
He looked southward.
"Yes," Tavlakov said. "But we could also be placing ourselves between two enemies. Danger on all sides."
"Those behind will catch us, Tavlakov," Shallan said.
"Aye."
"A man hunting game will return with a mink if there are no Telm to be found," she said. "Those deserters have to kill to survive out here. Didn't you say there was probably going to be a high storm tonight?"
"Yes," Tavlakov said, reluctant. 2 hours after sunset, if the list I bought is correct."
"I don't know how bandits normally weather the storms," Shallan said, "but they've obviously committed to chasing us down. I'd bet they plan to use the wagons as shelter after killing us. They're not going to let us go."
"Perhaps," Tavlakov said. "Yes, perhaps. But Brightness, if we see that second column of smoke ahead, so might the deserters."
"Yeah,"
Tag said, nodding, as if he'd only just realized it.
"We cut east. The killers might go after the group ahead."
"We let them attack someone else instead of us?" Shallan said, folding her arms.
"What else would you expect us to do, Brightness?" Tavlakov said, exasperated. "We are small Kremlings, you see. Our only choice is to keep away from larger creatures and hope for them to hunt one another."
Shallan narrowed her eyes, inspecting that small column of smoke ahead. Was it her eyes, or was it growing thicker? She looked backward. Actually, the columns looked to be about the same size. "They won't hunt prey their own size," Shallan thought. "They left the army, ran away. They're cowards." Nearby, she could see Bluth looking backward as well, watching that smoke with an expression she couldn't read. Disgust? Longing? Fear? No spren to give her a clue. Cowards, she thought again. Or just men disillusioned. Rocks who started rolling down a hillside, only to start going so quickly they don't know how to stop. It didn't matter. Those rocks would crush Shallan and the others, if given the chance. Cutting eastward wouldn't work. The deserters would take the easy kill, slow-moving wagons, instead of the potentially harder kill straight ahead. "We make for the second column of smoke," Shallan said, sitting down. Tavlakov looked at her.
"You don't get it."
He broke off as she met his eyes. "You..." Tavlakov said, licking his lips.
"You won't get to the Shattered Plains as quickly, Brightness, if we get tied up with a larger caravan, you see. It could be bad."
"I will deal with that if the problem arises, tradesman Tavlakov."
"Those ahead will keep moving," Tavlakov warned. "We may arrive at that camp and find them gone."
In which case, Shallan said, they will either be moving toward the shattered plains, or coming this way, along the corridor toward the port cities. We will intersect them eventually, one way or another. Tevlakov sighed, then nodded, calling to Tag to hurry. Shallan sat down, feeling a thrill. Bluth returned and took his seat, then shoved a few wizened roots in her direction. Lunch, apparently. Shortly, the wagons began rolling northward, Shallan's wagon falling into place third in line this time. Shallan settled into her seat for the trip. They were hours away from that second group, even if they did manage to catch up to it. To keep from worrying, she finished her sketches of the landscape. She then turned to idle sketches, simply letting her pencil go where it willed. She drew sky eels dancing in the air. She drew the docks of Carbronth. She did a sketch of Yalb, though the face felt off to her, and she didn't quite capture the mischievous spark in his eyes. Perhaps the errors related to how sad she became, thinking of what had probably happened to him. She flipped the page and started a random sketch, whatever came into her mind. Her pencil moved into a depiction of an elegant woman in a stately gown, loose but sleek below the waist, tight across the chest and stomach, long open sleeves, one hiding the safe hand, the other cut at the elbow, exposing the forearm and draping down below. A bold, poised woman, in control. Still drawing unconsciously, Shallan added her own face to the elegant woman's head. She hesitated, pencil hovering above the image. That wasn't her, was it? Could it be? She stared at that image as the wagon bumped over rocks and plants. She flipped to the next page and started another drawing. A ball gown, a woman at court, surrounded by the elite of Alethkar as she imagined them. Tall, strong, the woman belonged among them. Shallan added her face to the figure. She flipped the page and did another one, and then another. The last one was a sketch of her standing at the edge of the shattered plains as she imagined them, looking eastward, toward the secrets that Yasna had sought. Shallan flipped the page and drew again. A picture of Yasna on the ship, seated at her desk, papers and books sprawled around her. It wasn't the setting that mattered, but the face. That worried, terrified face, exhausted, pushed to her limits. Shallan got this one right. The first drawing since the disaster that captured perfectly what she'd seen. Yasna's burden. "Stop the wagon," Shallan said, not looking up. Bluth glanced at her. She resisted the urge to say it again. He didn't, unfortunately, obey immediately. "Why?" he demanded. Shallan looked up. The smoke column was still distant, but she'd been right. It was growing thicker. The group ahead had stopped and built a sizable fire for the midday meal. Judging by that smoke, they were a much larger group than the one behind. "I'm going to get into the back," Shallan said. "I need to look something up. You can continue when I'm settled, but please stop and call to me once we're near to the group ahead." He sighed, but stopped the chull with a few whacks on the shell. Shallan climbed down, then took the knobweed and notebook, moved to the back of the wagon. Once she was in, Bluth started up again immediately, shouting back to Tevlakov, who had demanded to know the meaning of the delay. With the walls up, her wagon was shaded and private, particularly with it being last in line so nobody could look in the back door at her. Unfortunately, riding in the back wasn't as comfortable as riding in the front. Those tiny rock buds caused a surprising amount of jarring and jolting. Yasna's trunk was tied in place near the front wall. She opened the lid, letting the spheres inside provide dusky illumination, then settled back on her improvised cushion, a pile of the cloths Yasna had used to wrap her books. The blanket she used at nights, as Tevlakov had been unable to produce one for her, was the velvet lining she had ripped out of the trunk. Settling back, she unwrapped her feet to apply the new knobweed. They were scabbed over and much improved from their condition just a day before. "Pattern?" He vibrated from somewhere nearby. She'd asked him to remain in the back, so as to not alarm Tavlakov and the guards. "My feet are healing," she said. "Did you do this?"
"I know almost nothing of why people break. I know less of why they unbreak."
"Your kind don't get wounded?" she asked, snapping off a knobweed stem and squeezing the drops onto her left foot.
"We break. We just do it differently than men do. And we do not unbreak without aid. I do not know why you unbreak. Why?"
"It is a natural function of our bodies," she said. "Living things repair themselves automatically." She held one of her spheres close, searching for signs of little red rotspren. Where she found a few of them along one cut, she was quick to apply sap and chase them off.
"I would like to know why things work," Pattern said.
"So would many of us," Shallan said, bent over. She grimaced as the wagon hit a particularly large rock. "I made myself glow last night, by the fire with Tavlakov."
"Yes.
Do you know why?"
"Lies."
"My dress changed," Shallan said. "I swear the scuffs and rips were gone last night. They've returned now, though."
Yes.
"I have to be able to control this thing we can do." Yasna called it light weaving. She implied it was far safer to practice than soul casting.
"The book?"
Shallan frowned, sitting back against the bars on the side of the wagon. Beside her, a long line of scratches on the floor looked like they'd been made by fingernails, as if one of the slaves had tried in a fit of madness to claw his way to freedom. The book Yasna had given her, Words of Radiance, had been swallowed by the ocean. It seemed a greater loss than the other one Yasna had given her,